And now, fighting out of the red corner, CagePotato.com!
Bruce Buffer, everybody! Let's hear it for him!
And I'm not going to touch that one with a 25-foot pole, Moro.
I'd like to touch it with a 25-centimeter one, but instead we'll just call the fight as now with Neon.
I'm not impressed by your performance.
Yo, this your boy Kimbo Slice. Check this out. When you ain't got shit to do and you're in front of your computer, I want you to read CagePotato.com. CagePotato.com. Because tapping out is for bitches.
My name is Carl the Heat Breeze, and listen to Bum Rush Radio.
I'm Steve Velasquez, and Cage Potato is the best.
This is Jorge Rivera, and you're listening to the Bum Rush Radio Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Bum Rush Radio Show, brought to you by CagePotato.com. I'm Ben Goldstein. With me are Mike Russell and Chad Dundas. My God, what a week it's been, and what a weekend it's going to be. This Saturday brings us UFC 128, Shogun versus Jones, which will be Zuffa's first event since buying Strikeforce last weekend. Yes, we're still trying to deal with the implications of it all, and we'll be discussing all that today. Later on the show, Brendan Schaub will be joining us, as well as Jeffrey the Killa Watts, also known as Karma Ate My Cat, who is on his way to New Jersey for the Ultimate Fighter 14 auditions as we speak, thanks to your generosity, Potato Nation. So let's get into the biggest news of the week, Zuffa's purchase of Strikeforce. To quickly recap, Scott Coker's partners, Silicon Valley Sports and Entertainment, were reportedly nervous about the amount of debt that Strikeforce was running up, and they wanted to get out of the game and refocus on their main asset, which is running the San Jose Sharks hockey franchise. So they pressured Coker to sell. The UFC swooped in. It was the first anybody had ever heard of it. It was a surprise. They paid a figure that some reporters are saying was about $40 million to buy Strikeforce. Coker staying on to run the ship until further notice. Does Zuffa have a monopoly on the sport now? Is this good for MMA? That's been a subject of heated debate over the last few days. Chad, we'll start with you since, I mean, it seems like every Cage Potato writer sort of weighed in one way or the other, but you wrote a bit of a devil's advocate piece for the site saying this was not good for the sport. Why do you think it isn't?
To answer your first question, I don't think that Zuffa has a legal monopoly. I don't think anyone could take him to court, and I don't think a judge would find that they have a legal monopoly just because there are still other companies out there like Bellator and MFC and, you know, relatively mid-major promotions, I guess you'd call them, who would probably prevent any sort of monopoly or antitrust ruling against Zuffa. On the other hand, I mean, I think that they have an effective monopoly. I think they have a practical monopoly. If you want to, you know, apply your skills at the highest level in the sport and earn a living wage, so to speak, and there's no one you can do it for now except for Zuffa and by extension the UFC and by extension Dana White. And I guess my point in the piece that I wrote on the site is just that can't possibly be good for anyone else in the sport besides the people who now control the means of production. You know, I suppose you could make a case that it's good for fans just because the opportunity exists now to maybe see some of those dream matchups that we thought, you know, that we've all been kind of debating about and talking about a lot. But at the same time, it sounded like, you know, Dana White came out, and at least if you believe his interview with Ariel Helwani, he said that they're actually not going to do those matchups. So there goes that, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it just seems like this seeds more and more power to the Zuffa offices, to Dana White, to the Fertitta brothers. And, you know, we've seen in the past that those guys certainly don't forgive and forget They can be a little erratic sometimes with the way that they run the sport. And I think that the problem, like I wrote on the site, is that other sports that have these, in essence, monopolies, like the NFL, the NBA, they sort of out of necessity, are run by policy and like legal precedent and stuff like that. And mixed martial arts isn't run on those terms. Mixed martial arts is run according to Dana White's like sometimes crazy whims. So I think that creates potentially a big, big problem for fighters out there who are trying to earn a living.
Yeah. Now, I wrote my own column about this, looking to the future a little more optimistically, saying that maybe a single major league division is what MMA needs to become a major sport. And maybe this will force things like fighter unions, which will lead to things like health care and pensions and contracts that the UFC can't just, break at the drop of a hat. Mike, where do you lie on this? Doom and gloom or rose colored glasses?
Well, I think something that people are overlooking is the fact that there's not going to be a lot of options for a guy like a Paul Daly who gets cut from the UFC. Before he was like, well, I can go fight elsewhere. Well, you look at the fact that Strikeforce was the number two organization that was out there that people, if they lost a few fights and left the UFC or left on bad terms, they could go and fight for Strikeforce. Well, now their options are pretty limited. It's like the difference between the NFL and the Arena Football League with organizations like the MFC and, you've got Bama, I guess, is coming out and trying to say that they're going to take the reins of where Strikeforce left off. But I don't see that happening. And to me, as far as it being a monopoly, I don't see it being, like Chad said, it's not really a monopoly as far as it's, I guess, the UFC and Zuffa taking over, taking out the competition. I think there was a question. There was a lot of people, who argued the fact that Strikeforce was the number two organization. Some people, I guess playing devil's advocate, said they were the number one organization. So now, Dana White has just erased the competition. So there is no clear cut number two. So I think basically what he's done is left, zero doubt in everybody's mind who the number one organization is. I don't think there really was with most of the people who were, I guess, followed the sport for a while and that were sane. But I don't know. I wonder what's going to happen to a lot of these fighters once they leave Zuffa. Like, is it going to cause them to have to go out and get real jobs? Because I know that MFC is not paying great money. I guess some of their marquee guys, I know what they make and I won't reveal it, but they're making enough that they can get by with their sponsorships and everything else, but they definitely could not survive just on their MFC salary and different organizations like that. I don't think there's none out there, I don't think, that are doing say what the IFL did, where they were paying a livable wage. So I don't know. It's interesting. I want to wait and see what happens once the smoke clears in a couple of years. I think they're going to do what everybody says they're going to do, and they're going to sit out, when everybody's contracts are up in 2 years, the TV contracts and everybody who's under contract with Strikeforce, and then we'll probably slowly see it either dissolve or turn into a feeder league. But
yeah,
I don't know. Dana says no, but you know what? Business as usual doesn't necessarily mean business as usual as we've been seeing.
Right. Well, maybe Bellator will swoop in and take the guys that Zuffa refuses to work with, like Daly and Josh Barnett. And, they already have TV contracts right now, so maybe they will become that number two at some point until they eventually get bought out by Zuffa and the whole process starts all over again. But so one of the other tidbits that emerged was that Strikeforce has its contracts with Showtime until 2014. But, since the UFC, as Dana White said, they could just sign Strikeforce fighters after their contracts with the promotion are up, there might not really be anything worthwhile left in 2014. Dana White, as you said, keeps saying business as usual. Mike, when do you think Strikeforce will be inevitably folded? What's the over-under here? Will it last as long as the WEC did, for example, before getting closed down?
You know what? I think that because there's a lot of people like us saying that it won't, I think just to prove us wrong, Dana may keep it around longer than we expect, just to throw it in guys like our faces. But I don't know. I think that he's got a pretty good thing going. They've already got their TV contract. They've already got a following. They've already got a fan base built with Strikeforce and a brand built with Strikeforce. For them to take it over and even change the look of it, which, some people are questioning whether the shows are going to have a different look, whether they're going to have new commentary teams, which, let's be honest, Dana has never been a fan of Gus Johnson, Mauro Ranallo. I think that once everybody's contracts are up that he doesn't like, there's going to be the Zuffa touch on everything. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm hopeful to say that it will be around because, let's be honest, I like to have MMA choices to watch, not just once or twice a month, which hopefully this will do. And I know there's talk of them coming to Ontario here, and you know, as we've talked about, we're hoping that our credentials still remain with Strikeforce. We don't know if that's going to be affected with the merger, with the purchase. But I'm optimistic. I'm going to say that they're probably going to be around at least till 2014. We'll give them a 3-year window.
Okay. You know, I sort of agree with that, just because it makes sense. I mean, you know, you have Strikeforce as one of your assets. You know, you have a promotion that's able to do things like have a crazy heavyweight tournament, which UFC doesn't do, or have fights with Gina Carano and Cyborg or Chris Santos, which the UFC will not do. Just having that around so you could you could profit off these sort of, you know, I don't want to call them stunts, but they're the experiments that the UFC is not part of their game plan.
Yeah.
There's value in that. So that there's no reason they shouldn't keep the promotion around. So
it's like their focus group, you know, they've got a way to test out things. And if it fails, they say, that was a stupid Strikeforce idea now.
Yeah. You know, that's a good way of putting it. So I think 3 years is a reasonable estimate. Chad, you're a little more pessimistic on this one too, right?
Yeah. It's crossed my mind over the last few days that they're probably keeping Strikeforce alive just because it would be a legal hassle for them to kill it at this point, just because of the pre-existing contracts. My understanding of the Showtime deal, and this could be wrong, is that the Strikeforce has a deal with Showtime through 2012, and then Showtime has the option of extending that to 2014. So to me, it depends on if Zuffa does want to be able to put on these quote-unquote experimental events like the heavyweight Grand Prix and women's MMA, I guess, if you want to call that experimental, then I suppose what you're saying is absolutely right, that it does make sense for them to have a different brand, for them to kind of stage those events without like sullying the name of the UFC or whatever their ridiculous complaints are. But if they're not interested in being in the business of women's MMA and they're not interested in any of the other things that Strikeforce has to offer, then I don't think it makes any sense at all to keep the brand around. Especially when, you know, if you're not able to draw any clear distinctions between the two brands, except for that one appears to be slightly shittier than the other, it doesn't make any sense for the UFC to keep it around. So, I mean, I think I lean toward the option that the UFC as soon as it can probably takes over Strikeforce and at least rebrands everything under the UFC name.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that would entail exactly, but to me it just doesn't really make all that much sense to keep Strikeforce around.
Yeah. Well, the sale's already having some sort of weird synergistic consequences. As we've read, elbows to the head on the ground are now legal in Strikeforce since it's part of the unified rules of combat that the UFC follows. Gina Carano will be promoting a UFC personal trainer video game. I think I wrote this on the site. I found it sort of a little cynical that Dana White has pretty much stated there won't be a women's division of the UFC, but meanwhile has no qualms about exploiting Gina Carano as a spokesmodel. Is there a long-term future for women's MMA? Mike, your thoughts?
Well, you know, what's funny is he doesn't have Cyborg doing it. So I think we know exactly where he's coming from with
that. Yeah, that's like the cynical part of it. Exactly.
Yeah. So, to me, you know, he's already said, people have asked since the purchase whether or not he's thinking of bringing women into the UFC, and that could be another reason why he's keeping Strikeforce around. You know, it's like you said, it's a place where kind of the what he probably looks at as like some of these quirky, you know, fringe fights, you know, because maybe that's where all the freak show fights will be. Maybe that's where, you know, we'll see Ray Mercer and all these other, you know.
Well, that's not a bad idea, keeping it around just for freak show fights.
Yeah, because that's what, you look at Elite XC, and that's kind of what they took the reins from Elite XC once Elite XC folded. So, I don't know. To me, I can see him keeping it around just for that purpose, because let's be honest, women's MMA is still, you know, there's probably a 50-50 split between people that have been, I guess their minds have been changed about it, and there's people that won't give it a chance. You know, even on the site, I've noticed whenever we put up anything like the Marloes Kunin interview that we put up, people were torn between saying, you know, yeah, they put on great fights, and other people just don't want to see women fight. So to me, I can see him keeping it around because really there's no other place for women to fight. And, you know, for them to take that away and to kill it effectively, yeah. I don't know where else they go. Like MFC, Bellator, you know, Bellator probably would be the next best thing for a place for women to go. But they'll never make the money even that they make in Strikeforce, which is still, you know, pretty low compared to what male fighters make.
Yeah, and that's sort of what bothers me a little bit is you know, when the UFC says, you know, we're not going to have these women's divisions because there's not enough talent out there. Well, you know, that's why you you put the resources into it and put the promotion into it and create these divisions. And it's like, look, men's 135 pounds used to be a talent poor division too. And then you had promotions like the WEC come along and give them a place to fight. And eventually it becomes, you know, one of the most stacked classes in the world. It tells me a little that maybe just Dana White just doesn't like it on a personal level. But I don't know, Chad, is this worth, is it worth putting the, if you're the UFC, is it worth putting resources and effort into, you know, bringing, you know, fostering women's MMA, you know, if you're the only game in town?
I mean, I think it does, but that's just because I'm a fan and silly me, I like the idea of equality and having, women fighters have a place to be able to compete and make decent money, you know, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that's the real danger of this Strikeforce UFC merger is that we just see more and more stuff get run and fall under the thumb of Dana White's opinions. You know, I think it's a little bit Pollyanna-ish to think that they're going to keep Strikeforce around and keep the women's division around because it would be too mean for them to disband it. Like, he doesn't give a shit. He doesn't like it. If he doesn't like it, they're just not going to do it. It's kind of like, the response to my piece about the merger being bad for the sport on FightLinker, they wrote about how, well, the UFC is just going to have more money. And so that means they'll pay the fighters more money. And it's just like, man, really? No, actually, no. Anybody who knows anything about the history of business in America knows that guys who own companies don't pay their employees more money just because they are making more money. It doesn't make any sense. So I think, yeah, I see a lot more danger here than positives, I guess, across the board. And I think the division that's hit the worst is the women's division, because if Dana White doesn't want to do it, there's just not going to be a major promotion out there that gives the women a chance to fight.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to a couple other news topics, because we do have a lot to get through on the show. BJ Penn versus John Fitch 2, we just learned today, booked for UFC 132 in July. My question, why make this fight again? Is the UFC really trying to determine a welterweight title contender with this fight? I'm not that crazy about seeing it again. You know, I don't know, you know, what the fan reaction is, but what's your reaction? Chad, we'll start with you.
Yeah, it's not one that really stokes the fires anymore. I think that I guess a lot of people think BJ won the first fight. So I guess it's interesting to me in that regard, because I don't think he'll win the second one. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, he came out and surprised Fitch with his game plan in the first fight. And in essence, I think BJ showed his whole hand in this fight. And I don't know what he does in the second fight to sort of, like, you know, turn the tide in his favor.
Take the back sooner so he can have more time to work on that choke.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I don't think he'll be able to come out and take Fitch down again like he did in this first fight. I think Fitch will be wise to that at this point. And, you know, we saw towards the end of the first fight that it seemed like Fitch was starting to turn the tide. And, you know, if he's not surprised by BJ's game plan, I think Fitch pretty much has this one in the bag. And, you know, if St. Pierre is really going to leave the division, then they have to do something to find a number one contender. So I guess this booking it makes sense to me, but it doesn't particularly, you know, excite me.
Yeah, that's a good point, because, you know, I think after the fight, John Fitch said, you know, I really wasn't expecting BJ to come at me like that and try to, you know, try for these takedowns. Mm-hmm. So now he is expecting that. So it'll be a different kind of fight. I don't know, maybe a stand up fight. Who knows? Mike, is it a necessary fight?
It looks to me like the UFC just wants to see John Fitch lose, and they want to give BJ as many chances. If you look at the fact that BJ hasn't really earned a title shot, and they're talking about this having title implications, you know, he comes out and he beats Matt Hughes, and then, you know, really, Matt Hughes hasn't been a contender for a while. I think we touched on this the last show, but I don't know. I really don't know what they're thinking. I think BJ should be back down at 155. I don't think he has what it takes to compete with a guy the size and the skill of GSP. You know, even Fitch, he was a little bit smaller this fight because of his diet, but I really don't understand why this fight has to happen again just for to prove a point of who is the definitive winner. But I don't know. I'm going to play devil's advocate and disagree. I think that BJ will probably win this fight. I don't know why. I just, you know, maybe it's the sentimental side of me that just hates watching a John Fitch fight. So I'm going to say, yeah, he's going to win by John Fitch never gets finished. So let's say he'll win by decision.
Unanimous, split?
We'll go split, because what's a John Fitch fight and a BJ fight without a little controversy?
Right. All right, and this is going to lead nicely into our event preview today, but Rashad Evans and John Jones, not buddies anymore. This is the other sort of big story this week. And we all knew it was going to be awkward when John Jones got the title shot to replace his injured friend, but then Jones, I guess, made the mistake of saying that he would fight Rashad if it's what the UFC really wanted. And then on UFC 128 conference call later, he let his emotions come out a little bit because people kept asking him about Rashad. And he said, I'm just going to read this little quote. I absolutely hate when people mention Rashad Evans, especially throughout this training camp. Rashad is not in my mind. He's not in my being. He has absolutely zero to do with my heart and who I am right now. This guy has nothing to do with Shogun. And I think from here on out, I won't even answer a question about Rashad. So Rashad says he'll fight, Rashad's like, I'm no punk. I'll fight him too. So there are rumors now that he's leaving the Jackson camp over this. So whose team are you on with this one? I'm a little split, but should Jones be criticized for his disloyalty, whatever that means, or should Rashad be criticized for getting all butthurt and sensitive? Chad, your thoughts?
Well, I think isn't the first person who came out and said that they thought that, I mean, the first person from one of the camps who came out and said that they thought that this fight should happen was Trevor Whitman. Right. My knowledge, right? And, you know, from what I had heard in the past, that Rashad and John Jones had never really been that close of friends. And in fact, Rashad had primarily prepared for his last two fights or last two or three fights up at Grudge Training Center in Colorado. So it was my understanding that Rashad was doing most of his work with Trevor Whitman and those guys in Colorado anyway.
Do you think that's because he was like threatened from the beginning by Jones? Like what's the story behind that?
Do you want to know the truth? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just my opinion. I can't base that in fact. Some people have told me things that lead me to believe that, but I mean, I think that John Jones, regardless of the nice guy, aw shucks persona that he likes to try to put on in public, which I think he needs to drop as soon as possible, because I think it's going to make people dislike him more than otherwise. I think that he at base in his heart of hearts has to be the man. And I think that Rashad Evans is the same way. I think they both of them see themselves as the top fighter out there, and they both, you have to be the undisputed king of the training camp. And I don't think that there's enough room for both of them to be in the same camp. And I heard things to that effect, and that's why Rashad has been up working in Colorado so much. So to have him quote unquote leave Jackson, I guess it hurts from sentimental point of views, but for all intents and purposes, I think he had sort of already left Jackson.
Right.
So I don't think there's a bad guy in this situation. I just think, man, if you're the number one and number two fighters in the world, sometimes you have to fight even if you're friends. And it's kind of soap opera style to watch it go down like this, but I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah. Now there's another wrinkle to the story, which is Greg Jackson himself. Now, Mike, you were telling me a little about how when Jones first came to the Team Jackson camp, there was sort of a promise made about, you know, we don't fight each other. Tell me, basically tell the listeners a little more about that whole situation. First and foremost.
Yeah, there was Rashad. We even talked about it in one of the interviews the other day before Jones joined the camp. I guess Greg kind of took him aside and said, listen, we want to bring in John Jones. You know, he's asked if he can come train with us, you know, basically hyped him up and said he's this, you know, promising young talent, and that, you know, I think it'd be good for not only the team, it'd be good for him. It'd be good to have an extra training partner. So anyway, he said, but don't worry, he'll never challenge you. If, you know, say you win the title, he's not going to want to fight you. There's not going to be anything like that. So right off the bat, you know, I guess to preface something like that, you know, with a speech like that, and then have this come out and him, you know, go for the title that has your name on it, you know, is kind of strange. I can understand both sides of it. You know, Jones being offered a title shot, who's really going to want to turn it down regardless of what happens? And there's been, you know, all these different stories that come out. Like Jones on the preview show the other day said that before it was announced and before his fight with Bader, they had a dinner with the team, and he said Rashad approached him and said, listen, I don't know what's going to happen, but they might come to you after the fight and offer you the fight with Shogun because I'm hurt. So, you know, he had an idea it was going to happen. He never really said much about it other than, you know, don't get your hopes up, but it might happen. So, you know, maybe Jones took it as a you have my blessing type of thing, like take the fight because it was him telling him. But I don't know. To me, I could see both sides of it, but if I had to look at it from the outside, I'd look at the fact that, you know, it was Rashad's title shot. He waited a year for it, which is a pretty big, you know, everybody questioned the fact that he was sitting out as long as he was. And you know, a lot of people thought he was kind of, you know, ridiculous for him to sit out that long to wait for a title shot. But then, you know, it's almost like Dana White was proving a point that, because he didn't want him to wait out that long either. So as soon as it comes that he's actually injured, he yanks it out from under him and gives it to someone else. So I don't know. There's a lot of different stories. It just kind of harkens back to the whole Diego Sanchez when George St. Pierre came in. Because, you know, you look at the fact that George was the golden boy coming in, you know, with the title and everything else. Or maybe it was – I think it might have been just after he'd lost the title to Sarah. But, you know, it almost looks the same. It doesn't look too good on Greg Jackson when you look at the fact that – you know, it almost, it's like somebody younger and cuter comes along, you know, like a new wife, basically.
Yeah.
And he's fawning over them. So I don't know. We don't know what's going on inside the camp, but, you know, there's lots of options, I think, for Rashad. Like Jonathan Schamberg told me that, you know, as much as they're all one big team, there's certain guys that don't necessarily work together. Like, he's never really worked with John Jones, but yet people always assume that because he's part of Team Jackson, does most of everybody's cardio and strength training, that, you know, he's responsible for it. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But everybody's putting the apple before the cart before the horse here, because he has to go out and beat Shogun before any of this becomes an issue. So
sure,
I mean, everybody's talking about it like he's already won.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. I mean, you know, when the Rashad thing, the story about him leaving the camp first came out, I thought, you know, come on, aren't you being a little sensitive? But then I do sympathize more in the sense that, like, you just put yourself in Rashad Evans' shoes, man. I mean, you got two training partners, same division. One of them, John Jones, is just, like, everybody's on his nuts in the MMA world, and he hasn't even had his title fights yet. And meanwhile, Rashad, like, everybody just hates him for seemingly no reason. It's just like you got a fan favorite and just like a heel. And not a self-made heel either. I mean, Rashad wanted to be liked, and the fans just didn't get behind him. And it's just like, you know, he feels he's getting no support, and it's a shame. But hey, you know, if he can pursue happiness somewhere else, that's fine. I don't think it's the right move personally, and I think there is room for two contenders in the same camp, but apparently they don't. But as you said, it's a shame, because this story, along with John Jones's hype, is the reason that Shogun is being almost completely overlooked and overshadowed in this fight. Nobody's even talking about him. So let's move on to UFC 128 this weekend, Newark, New Jersey. The main event, Mauricio Shogun Hua versus John Jones. You know, as I said, between the hype and this juicy storyline, not only are fans and some journalists counting Shogun out of the fight completely, but a win for Shogun almost seems like a worst-case scenario. Like, we don't even want to think about it. So what are Shogun's chances for an upset? Does he have a clear path to victory? Chad, what do you think?
I think the fight – I think
– You're right.
What was that noise?
I don't know. I thought it was you.
What was that? No, it sounded like a car went by inside my brain there for a second. I don't know what that was.
Maybe there was.
Yeah, I guess so. Let me start again, I guess. Sure. Well, hope that doesn't happen again. I think it's probably a closer fight than the odds indicate. I see it as more of a pick'em, just because I don't think anybody really has any idea what can happen or what will happen in this fight. You know, the physical advantages seem to all favor Jones. He's just so big and so athletic and so unorthodox that you think that he might be able to come out and just overwhelm Shogun. On the other hand, you know, no one's ever put John Jones in a bad spot in a fight. And I think if anyone can do it right now, it's Shogun, just because he's been so aggressive and so, you know, effective in what he's done over the years that it'll be interesting to see how John Jones responds if Shogun is able to either put him on the defensive or hurt him or even like push him into kind of deep water and test his cardio. It'll be interesting to see how John Jones, you know, is able to respond to that, because he is, in essence, a little bit untested in the fact that, he's gotten 100% on every test that they've given him so far. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's hard to pick Shogun, though, I think, in this fight, just because he's coming in off the knee injury. You know, he's like 1,000th knee injury, and he's never looked good after these long layoffs where he's had to do rehab, et cetera, et cetera. I've said all along that I think pulling the rug out from under Shogun and changing his opponent 6 weeks out hurts him at least as much as it hurts John Jones, just because I don't think that, you know, Shogun says otherwise, but I don't think that preparing for John Jones is even in the same ballpark as preparing for Rashad Evans. I just don't think they're the same kind of fighters, really. Whereas for Jones, you have to believe that even if Evans was doing most of his preparation in Colorado, that Greg Jackson already sort of had a game plan for Shogun, probably had already watched a lot of film on Shogun, probably already had the tape, so to speak, on Shogun. And then that strategy could just sort of be imposed on John Jones. Probably not 100%, because Jones is going to do things a lot differently than Rashad. But, you know, I think the short notice affects both camps. So, yeah, like I said, it's hard to pick Shogun here, but if Jones goes out and walks through Shogun the same way he walked through Ryan Bader and walked through Matyushenko and walked through Brandon Vera, I'll be surprised, and I'll be a little bit scared at that point.
Definitely. I mean, I think Shogun has a, you know, advantage. He's, you know, maybe more of a better technical striker. But other than that, I mean, yeah, the knee injury, the layoff thing, it makes me nervous. You know, Jones's physical advantages are just incredible. You know, I'm obviously picking him on this fight. I think that the check marks, just too many of them line up in Jones's favor. And yeah, I'll be a little bit scared too if he runs through Shogun. Mike, how do you see it?
It's interesting to note too. Like, I don't know if you guys watched the preview show at all, and I know I talk about it a lot, but when Jones was saying that when Rashad was getting ready for the fight, it was his job to mimic Shogun. So he said, you know, he basically was watching tape, almost like when he was stalking Ryan Bader. He's like talking about how he basically became Shogun for, I don't know, the 3 or 4 weeks of the beginning of camp. So it's interesting to know if Shogun, you know, how long ago was he watching tape from? Was it the, you know, quote unquote old Shogun, the new Shogun, the old new Shogun? I don't know.
The new adventures of old Shogun.
Yeah. The pre knee injury Shogun. It's very, I don't know. I think, you know, each fighter's talking about what their game plan's going to be. They could both be red herrings, but we've got, you know, Jones talking about how he's going to put him on his back and he's going to try to choke him out or do whatever he can to him, because, you know, his confidence is high from what he did to Ryan Bader, which Ryan Bader and Shogun, I think, have quite different credentials when it comes to jiu-jitsu. So Shogun's talking about how he's going to chop his little skinny legs down and make it take his legs out from under him. But to me, I think people are underestimating Shogun. I think that the hype, even the hype that the UFC is putting out there, is swaying popular opinion. Even people that are Shogun fans, they're kind of buying into the whole PR campaign that the UFC has going. They've got that show coming on Spike Tonight, whatever it's called. I don't know, some hype show about John Jones.
In the Moments or something like that, right?
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. They've never done anything like that before. And it's, you know, from Joe Rogan to Mike Goldberg to everybody that talks about Jones these days has basically almost written Shogun off. So I'm an old school Shogun fan, and I have a feeling he's going to win it. And I don't know exactly how, but I'm kind of with Chad. I think that he might try to take him into some of the deeper waters and go past the third round, because, you know, this is Jones's first title fight, and he's 23 years old. He's only been training for 3 years. He's never faced a guy like Shogun, you know, and you look at, everybody talks about with the fight with Bader, he deserves this fight. Well, really, his biggest fight before that was like Brandon Vera, you know, and he had that fight with Matt Hamill. Well, really, there's nobody, the caliber of guys that he's beaten other than, say, Bader, which is kind of debatable too, because we saw a big hole in Bader's game. I think he was kind of scared of the hype and the striking of Jones and kind of put his neck out there, you know, literally put his neck out there and got choked out. But you look at the guys that Shogun's beaten, and, you know, people talk about how he lost that fight to Forrest, but like you talked about, he came back from that injury and his cardio was terrible. I think he just basically gave up in that fight. So I'm going to say that Shogun's going to win. I'm going to go fourth round TKO. I'm going to go out on a real limb here and say that he's going to actually finish Jones.
All right. You know, the deep waters thing is a good point. It's interesting. But that, of course, suggests that, you know, Shogun will be able to avoid getting taken down and elbowed into oblivion for 15 minutes. And that's when it starts to get a little sketchy for me, because I think Jones will be able to take Shogun down, you know, a few times, as many times as it takes. And, you know, to survive an onslaught like that will be tricky to pull off. So let's move on. The co-main event, Uriah Faber versus Eddie Wineland. You know, Wineland, to me, you know, in his last couple of fights, style is a little similar to Dominic Cruz in some respects. He's got this sort of herky-jerky in-and-out style, that unorthodox striking. So I'm interested in this matchup because it might say a lot about Faber's chances against Dominic Cruz down the road. So if Faber struggles against Eddie Wineland, and it doesn't bode well for him. Chad, in your gambling addiction enabler piece, you're sort of writing this one off, though. You're saying, you know, Wineland's going to get – it's almost a foregone conclusion that Faber will win this fight. You know, why do you think that?
I just think, you know, Uriah Faber, I just think Uriah Faber will be too good in all areas. I think that he knows full well that everything else that he's done in the past, all the accolades, all the accomplishments that he's massed up will pale in comparison to what he's able to do with the UFC hype machine behind him. And I think the UFC promotional arm is fully willing and ready to get behind Uriah Faber, and all he has to do is win this fight. I think he knows that. I think he knows how much is at stake. I think he'll come out and play this one in sort of vintage California kid style, take Wineland down and probably choke him out. I just don't, you know, Wineland's had he's going through a resurgence right now after a couple of years where he had some adversity that he had to overcome. But I just don't think, bottom line, I just don't think he's good enough to beat Uriah Faber. I think Faber will be a little bit more comfortable at 135 now, and will come out and put on a show, a pretty good show, I think. And I picked him to win in second round submission.
Got it. You know, I think if Wineland can keep it on the feet, he's got a shot at an upset, but that's a huge if, obviously. And, you know, what you're saying about Faber, just sort of bringing back the old Uriah and getting those takedowns, maybe getting a submission or a TKO. It is the more likely scenario, but I'm just not completely counting out Wineland because his striking has impressed me lately. Mike, where do you see it?
Wineland's one of those guys, I think, that kind of flies under the radar. People forget, you know, he was a WEC champion, and his last couple fights have been pretty impressive. I'm going to go with Wineland for the upset and for no
sets today from Mike. Wow.
Yeah. You know what? It must be St. Pat because it's St. Patty's Day. I'm in a good mood. Mind you, I think I'm always devil's advocate when it comes to picks. I'm pretty terrible. I think I have like about a 3-54 pick record. But no, I really am impressed with Wineland. I think, you know, he's a guy that I've kind of followed, you know, a lot of his fights for the last couple of years. And I think that he's going to probably win by decision because the only time that we see Uriah Faber get finished usually is when he's injured. So I'm going to go, yeah, we'll go with unanimous decision, and then we'll have Faber come out and say that he thought that he won the fight.
All right. Next fight on the card, lightweight division, Jim Miller versus Kamal Shalros. This kind of sucks for Jim Miller, doesn't it? I mean, this dude has won 6 fights in a row against solid competition, and he pulls Kamal Shalros, who is, you know, nobody really knows him outside the WEC. It's more of like, you know, a lot, nothing to gain, you know, a lot more to lose than to gain. Shalros, obviously a tough wrestler. He's beaten some guys in WEC, but, you know, he's not the most exciting fighter. He's, you know, he hasn't really put anybody away since his first fight in the WEC, you know, coming off a couple of very close decisions. He had that draw with Varner, I think it was last year. It's just not the matchup you want. It's not the step up that you'd expect from Miller, who's I mean, like I said on the site, like putting together a 6-fight win streak in the Octagon is really impressive no matter who you're fighting. So it's just too bad. I mean, I think he's the favorite in this fight. And we'll probably win, but it's just kind of a strange matchup. Mike, what do you make of it?
You know what? If I was Chad, I'd say this is definitely going to be the fight that Jim Miller gets upset because, you know, they've probably got plans for him of having a title shot 1 or 2 fights from now. And, you know,
I think it'll take a lot longer than that. I mean, if you look at the competition they're putting Jim Miller, they are slow building.
Yeah, you know what? I think they had Soteropoulos with the fast track, and then he got beaten. Mm-hmm. So now they're probably trying to get things back on track by having him fight Dunham, and maybe the winner will get something down the road. Who knows what? I think they've got a flow chart in the UFC office right now, and it's anytime something screws up, they probably are scrambling for a way to fix it. So,
and now with all these WEC fighters, it's just that flow chart is getting massive and crazy, yeah. And everything's looping back to itself.
Yeah. And we've got draws coming left, right, and center.
And that doesn't help.
No, and they don't know what to do with it. But yeah, I think this is an easy fight for Jim Miller to win. And, you know, I think maybe that's part of the reason why I didn't put him in my lightweight rankings was because you look at some of the guys he's beaten. Sure, they're decent fighters, a lot of them, but there's no real, you know, no really ranked fighters. And I think that's the UFC's fault because they're not putting him up against guys that, that are necessarily world beaters. So I think it's an easy fight for him to win. But yeah, if I was Chad, I'd probably say that this is definitely going to be a fight that he's going to lose.
Chad, Mike is putting words in your mouth. Do you agree with the words that he is putting in your mouth?
Well, it makes me feel like he really knows me as a person. Like he's a he knows how I feel about sort of like metaphysical, intangibles, just sort of feeling your way to the decision. But no, I think this is, I mean, anything can happen when Kamal Chalrus is in there because you know he's going to go out and just throw crazy haymakers out of his back pocket until he either breaks his hand or the other guy gets knocked out. At the same time, I agree with what you were saying, Ben, just because it kind of feels like the UFC really wishes that they didn't have Jim Miller around. Like, you know, he's won so many fights. The only guys he's lost to are Gray Maynard and Frankie Edgar. He's won like what, six in a row or something like that.
Yeah.
But he looks like a 1920s carnival wrestler. And like, he just doesn't have the it factor. He's kind of a boring fighter. He's kind of like a takedown oriented guy who grinds out decisions. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of seems like he's a thorn in the promotional side of the UFC. And so like they give him this fight against Kamal Chalrus, which is sort of like, doesn't mean anything if Jim Miller wins it, but if Jim Miller loses it, then, you know, he's effectively knocked out of the ranks of contenders.
But then on the other hand, they also need Jim Miller to destroy a guy like Kamal Chalrus before they take him to the next level. So he's always going to be on this sort of plateau until he either loses or wins big.
I guess, but it also, yeah, it just doesn't seem like, I think the odds are that Miller will lose a fight before they give him a title fight, just because they've got so many guys right now that they could potentially work into a title fight situation. Like, you know, the winner of Pettis and Guida could potentially get a title shot. Like Melvin Gallard has won 7 of his last 8 fights. And you would have thought that being, just considering his fighting style, him being a guy that the UFC probably would like to put into a high profile situation. Then they turn around and give him Shane Roller, which seems like an absolutely no win situation for Melvin Gallard.
Now Dennis Seaver's in the mix too, because he just beat Soteropoulos.
And you've got Dennis Seaver kind of hanging around, and at the same time, Jim Miller's still out there. There's just so many guys who could potentially work themselves into a situation to get a title shot. It just feels like, if I had to guess, I would say the least preferable guy on that list for the UFC is Jim Miller, and that's just because of the way they seem to be handling his career, like never really putting him in a high profile spot. I'm actually surprised that this fight is on the main card, just because I don't know who sells it. I don't know what kind of drawing power Jim Miller has, and I don't know if anybody even knows who Kamal Chalrus is, except for WEC hardcores. So yeah, I'm surprised, and I agree, it doesn't seem like the UFC is particularly high on Jim Miller for some reason.
On the other hand, the crowd's going to be behind him. You got a guy from New Jersey, hometown crowd, against an Iranian. How many chants of USA are we going to hear this night? And then his brother's on the card too. Transitioning nicely into that, the fight before that, actually, it's listed as a second fight on the main card, Dan Miller against Nate Marquardt. Marquardt, who filling in for Sexy Yama, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Dan Miller.
Dan Miller is. Yeah.
So, you know, Marquardt, he's coming back from a loss to Yushin Okami. Did not look great in that fight. Didn't have that killer instinct, the eye of the tiger. Dan Miller, he's had a couple, wins. He had a really rough patch in his personal life and his professional life. He lost 3 in a row, went through some personal tragedies. And now he's meeting up with Marquardt, who, as I said, did not look great in his last fight. I still think Marquardt has the tools to beat Dan Miller. He's obviously a more complete fighter. He has the power when he wants to use it or when he chooses to. Or have we seen a new, safer Nate Marquardt? Is this what we're seeing? Like, I mean, how much do you read into his last loss against Okami? Mike, what do you think?
This fight is a tough one for Marquardt because, you know, if he loses this fight to a guy who basically loses against every top competitor that he goes up against, from Bisping to Chael Sonnen to Damian Maia, you know, I think his chances of getting another title shot are pretty much sunk. But, you know, Marquardt, to me, I thought, you know, thought for sure he was going to win that fight against Okami. Even the fight with Sonnen, as much as, you know, I knew Sonnen was a tough guy, I just thought he was going to be too strong and too tough for Sonnen to beat. But I think that if he loses this fight, you know, that's three losses in his last 4 fights.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do with them? You know, obviously there's guys that have a pass when it comes to getting the axe from the UFC, but, you know, maybe we'll see him go to Strikeforce if he loses another fight, because
that's interesting.
Who knows what they're going to do with him. But yeah, I that Okami's kind of in waiting in the wings now. And I think Okami's almost like one of these guys like Fitch, who they basically don't really want to succeed and they don't really want to win. And I think Marquardt is the guy that they do want to. You know, he's this all-American looking guy that's, you know, he's pretty well-spoken. He's pretty popular. Other than, you know, some of the debatable things that he's done, you know, I guess in his career, like slamming people on their heads and getting in fights with cornermen for holding chokes too long and stuff like that. You know, there's, I think that they thought, you know, he was this marketing marvel that they were going to be able to use as a champion. And, you know, maybe they thought he was going to beat Anderson Silva at the time too. But I think they're kind of, you know, there's a lot of guys that they want to succeed that they're putting in with fights like this, even against him with a guy like Akiyama. You know, Akiyama definitely is not the same Akiyama we saw like even 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, to give him a fight like that, almost like a, well, we'll get you a decent name win. It's like fighting Vitor Belfort for a lot of these guys. People just want to do it because he's, you know, the killer from Pride, but he's definitely a shadow of his former self. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if he loses this fight, which he, let's be honest, anything could happen. I don't see it happening that he's going to go out there and lose to Dan Miller, but, you know, especially on short notice. But if he loses, I'm pretty interested to see what happens, you know, as far as what Dana says about it. Even, you know, Dana's never really said too much about Nate, you know, negative things about Nate, even when he loses. I think the last fight actually with Akiyama might have said something, but he's usually pretty respectful and pretty complimentary of him. So if he loses this fight, we'll see exactly what's said.
Yeah, I mean, if he loses, I think he'd get one more chance. But I also agree that this is sort of Nate's fight to win or lose. It really depends on how he shows up and how he performs. You know, no disrespect to Dan Miller, but, you know, Nate's the favorite in this one for a reason. Chad, what's your prediction for the result of this fight?
How, if you're the UFC, how could you look at Nate Marquardt and think that guy's marketable? Like, that's like that'd be like marketing a beige wall. I mean, the guy's just boring.
Yeah,
and I'm usually
steroid scandal too probably doesn't help.
Man, what a disastrous 2010 for Nate Marquardt, though. He came in, he had won 3 in a row, and then he goes 1-2, gets beat by Sonnen and Okami. You kind of get the impression that this might be his last gasp at like being a relevant 185-pound contender. Luckily for him, I think this is a fight that he wins pretty easily. He's never a guy that seems like he's going to come out and finish someone dramatically. So I think he probably beats Dan Miller by lopsided unanimous decision. But still, it's another, like, I know what they had to, you know, kind of scramble to make it after Akiyama had to pull out a sort of short notice. But at the same time, man, another fight that just doesn't sound like a pay-per-view fight to me. So I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, I think it's one that Marquardt certainly can win. And if he doesn't, probably means really bad things for his future.
All right. Leading off the card is a heavyweight bout between Mirko Krokop and Brendan Schaub. I think we can all agree if Krokop loses this one, he's done.
If.
So are you guaranteeing a win for Brendan Schaub, Chad Dundas?
Yes. I guarantee it. It's a slam bang.
That's your lock of the week.
Lock of the week of the century. Schaub wins. I'll go second round knockout. I just don't see how Krokop wins this. Schaub is too young. He's too athletic. He's too dynamic. I don't think, you know, Krokop probably won't try to take him down, but even if he had to, I don't think that he could. And I think that Schaub will best him on the feet. I think the least mysterious thing about this weekend's pay-per-view is that Mirko Krokop will show up looking tiny and pale and probably disinterested. He will come out to Duran Duran. He'll get finished.
He doesn't even enjoy it anymore. How can we expect to enjoy it?
Yeah, he'll get finished in the second or third round, and then probably call it quits.
Wow, that's a guarantee. Mike, do you agree? Is it that clear cut?
Well, you know what? I think Mirko's kind of digging his own grave with some of the comments he said before the fight. You know, he's been talking about how, yeah, Schaub is good. He's okay, but he's just a rookie. He's just a kid. Well, what's going to happen if that kid knocks you out or takes you down and beats the shit out of you? So I think I'm with Chad, where I think, you know, that this is almost Schaub's fight to lose, but, you know,
almost.
you look at the fact though that Schaub has that one KO loss to Roy Nelson, and that kind of, you know, leaves a little bit of doubt in my mind that you know, maybe it's not as much of a lock as Chad thinks it is. But
no, Krokop can't knock anybody out anymore. Come on.
Well, if he can kick over his head still, we'll be interested to see. He had the injury, but, you know, talking about the fight with that interview, I think, that we posted about a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, with it was the Croatian website that he did, and he was talking about how he kind of has a fear in him that he's going to get hurt now. And that's kind of why he hasn't been fighting like he used to fight, because he's worried about his kids. He's worried about his future. He's worried about his brain, you know, everything else. Where, I don't know, if he can put all that out of his head for one fight, you know, maybe he could do something and surprise us all. I think it's my sentimental pride.
Jed's not hearing it.
No, Jed, I might as well just be quiet. But no, I'd love
to
see him.
Tell the judge, Russell.
Love to see him come back and make a go of it. But even he's talking retirement. Every interview now, he's saying if he loses, he's going to retire. So it's almost like he's already got his paperwork filled out. So yeah, I'm going to say, as much as I say with a heavy heart, I'm going to say Schaub's going to win by decision, because I got a feeling that Mirko's not going to want to engage as much as he did with Pat Barry.
I'll split the difference and say TKO round three. Sorry, Crow Cop. It was quite a career.
Yep. Yeah, you still got politics and movies.
Yeah, and that win over Pat Barry. Yeah. By submission, no less. Anyway. Yep. So that's the main card. You know, I don't know if I want to spend too much more time on this, but I guess, you know, quickly, what's the fight from the prelims you want to see the most? What's the most compelling undercard fight, in your opinion? Chad, anything sticking out to you?
Let me look at it first.
Look at it.
It's not like I didn't just spend all day writing about it. I can't remember what it is.
Oh, you wrote about the undercard?
Yeah, I had to do my picks today.
Oh, good.
Hold on. Let me try to get this called up here. All right, here we go. Undercard.
What connection are you using? God damn.
Oh, no. All right, I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
Do I hear like a telegraph in the back?
All right, should I start now?
Go ahead.
All right.
Call me crazy. I think that the maybe the Elliot Marshall Louise Kane fight could be interesting, just because, you know, we ran the story on the site this week about how sad Elliot Marshall was for the last year after he got cut from the UFC, and he says he doesn't feel any urgency now that he forced his way back onto this card. But I mean, with all the talk and all the stories that were in that piece about how Joe Silva thought that Elliot Marshall was boring and told him he had to go out and finish somebody, you got to think that's going to be kicking around in his head somewhere when he goes out there to try to fight Louise Kane. I mean, I think Marshall does have a chance to win this fight if he plays it smart and tries to wrestle. But yeah, I just wonder if he's going to do something stupid, like try to be exciting and, you know, get himself knocked out against Louise Kane. So I'm interested to see that. I'm interested to see Edson Barboza, just to kind of see if he can continue to live up to the hype.
Right.
Mike Pyle against Ricardo Almeida is sort of, I think, an even matchup. So who knows how that'll turn out. And then you got Joseph Benavidez way down here on the dark, in the mm-hmm. dark matches against Ian Loveland, which seems surprising to me, because Benavidez, I think, is a guy who could be a star in that division and is certainly a guy who can be entertaining. So I think there are some fights to look at on the prelim card. Nothing that's really going to blow your mind, but those would be my picks, I guess.
Yeah, Benavidez is always a pleasure to watch, and it is kind of strange. I mean, this is a former title contender, and he's not even on Facebook. After Facebook, what else is there? I mean, are there going to be MySpace fights or Twitter fights? I don't know, but Loveland's kind of a wild card himself, because this is, I guess, his bantamweight debut, and he only had one fight in the WEC. I think this is Benavidez's fights, but you know, I hope it gets some airtime. And yeah, like you said, Barboza and Anthony Jukwani, that's just going to be a slugfest, man. These guys are just going to throw – someone's leg's going to get broken with a kick, I think, is how this one's going to end. So that's just going to be very exciting. It's a really good one to start the Spike broadcast with. Mike, anything else to add?
No, I think that's pretty much good. You guys are kind of overlooking. I like Kurt Pellegrino's always goes out, puts on a show. Gleison Tebow's a good fighter. I don't know if there's any that stand out, though. I think they're all kind of – you know, Mike Pyle, I can't believe after beating John Hathaway that he gets Ricardo Almeida. Very right. interesting to me. You know, it goes back to what the hell are they trying to do with these guys, you know? Almeida beat TJ Grant and then lost to Matt Hughes, you know, by Anaconda choke. I don't know. The undercard isn't something that I'm going to, you know, rush over to Facebook to watch probably on Saturday night.
The UFC right. just needs more fighters.
I was just
that's
thinking
what I think when I look at this card, don't you? Like, God. They need more fighters.
They should buy a promotion, and then in a couple of years, they'll have all the best fighters in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's go to the phones. On the phone now is Jeffrey the Killer Watts. That's a clever nickname. Known as Karma Ate My Cat on the Cage Potato Con section. Jeff is 2-1 as an amateur fighter. We posted the video of his last win on the site. And as you guys know, he was able to raise $900 through the generous donations of the Potato Nation to fund his trip to the Ultimate Fighter auditions this coming Monday. Jeff, how's it going, man?
Oh, it's going pretty good, man.
Cool.
It's been pretty exciting lately.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it was. I mean, to clarify, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. You're leaving tomorrow. How are you getting out there? Just let everybody know what you've been up to.
Oh, man, training compulsively. Training harder than I think I've ever trained in my life, man. Leaving it all on the mats. I trained so hard on Wednesday that I basically passed out and didn't even realize until I was woken up. I'm getting up there via Amtrak, and I leave at 3 o'clock from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I arrive at 5 o'clock on Saturday in Newark, New Jersey.
So where are you staying?
Saturday and Sunday, I'm still a little groggy. I'm going to be staying with one of my training partners, David Hipke. He's a pro who's also going to be trying out, but he's making his way over via plane. So,
that's cool. So are you guys just gonna be like working out together until Monday? Like, what's your plan for the weekend?
I've actually been approached by a couple people who are going to UFC 128. I believe those are the right numbers. And one of them said they may or may not have an extra ticket, and that they know more about it Saturday.
Cool.
So things should get interesting.
So, yeah, I saw on my Facebook today you had an article written about you in the, I guess, the Dunkirk, New York Observer. That's awesome. How did that come about?
It was written by Gibbs Snyder III. A lot of you guys... Keith know me as somebody who pretty much says whatever he thinks or whatever's on his mind, and it's pretty much how I roll in real life, you know. I'm the many faces of Karma. You know, he's always been there, and he works for the newspaper, and he was interested in the story and how I was doing, and he was really, enthused about how Keith Potato had pretty much come together and helped me raise the money, you know.
It's a touching human interest story. That's what I say, man. That's cool.
It is, man. Only Dana White thought that way, huh?
Well, so at the tryouts, I mean, how do you plan to stand out over there? I mean, hopefully they'll give you a chance to try out. I know it's a situation where, like, you don't have three pro fights, so it's, you know, it could be an issue, and I guess we're all prepared for that. But let's say you do get your shots, at least work out and show them what you got.
You mean, what am I going to do to stand out from everybody else?
Yeah, I guess so.
I have a couple of interesting submissions that I like to do. From what I've been told, they don't allow heel hooks or ankle locks or neck cranks. I mean, so, and I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of an ankle locking kind of guy, but I'm gonna bleach my mohawk, and nice. I don't know, what color do you think I should do?
I don't know, man. You're going to bleach your mohawk. I don't know, man. I think.
What color should I do it?
It should be like two colors alternating. It shouldn't be. Shouldn't it be like red and black? That's too done. That's too Mayhem Miller.
Yeah, that's very Dan Hardy. I'm sure the Potato Nation will have tons of poser comments following that.
I don't know. I wish I could just go full rainbow, man. Just give him a different look. Yeah, the whole spectrum, exactly. That's kind of. I mean, if you get on the show, would you be the sort of like the crazy shit starter, that kind of dude, or the guy
who keeps
himself and gets the job done?
Well, I already know that it's my hopes that you know how they have, they give you that list of, they give everybody a list of what they want. You know, they give them a list and they give you a bunch of shit.
Yeah,
on top of my list. doesn't realize you get trashed and drunk, is going to be colorful permanent markers.
Is that to write on people?
They'll find Dana White's name on their faces.
Yeah, again, don't wear the Cage Potato shirt. I don't want them counting you out right from the beginning. We still still got a free Cage Potato first.
Yeah, let's hope he doesn't. He's not a registered somebody who gets the Observer from Dunkirk, New York.
He's secretly one of the commenters on the site, though. That's how he keeps up with what we're doing. I think he's Loki. I'm not sure, though. I'm still figuring it out. And we also saw that you have your next fight already scheduled for the King of the Cage organization on April 9th. That's kind of awesome. Is that a pro fight or amateur?
It's an amateur fight. I really, before I went pro, before I heard about the Ultimate Fighter 14, I'd really hoped that I would be able to get like 8 amateur fights in and then jump over to pro. The crazy thing is I've never not been able to. This will be my first amateur fight that I won't be able to throw an elbow or a knee or.
They're not allowed.
No. King of the Cage is. It's going to be interesting. You know, I've heard a lot of good things and I've heard a lot of bad things. So I'm excited to see what happens, and I'm hoping my opponent learns to like, keep my name out of his mouth.
Yeah, you don't start foot stomps. Do you know anything about your opponent?
Well, I do. He tried to add me on Facebook, actually. I'm not going to say his name because that might. You know, people might start trolling him or trolling me. And from one troll to the rest, I appreciate that not happening.
Yeah, that's kind of a shady move trying to, I don't know, what was he after? He wanted to just like see your photos or something? Like, why would you try to add your opponent on Facebook that you don't even know?
I don't know. I've already got a girlfriend, though, and he's not pretty enough. So, I didn't add him. He's still sitting there waiting to be approved. After I break his feet on April 9th, I'll add him afterwards and ask him how it felt.
That's a great quote right there, man. So I don't know. I mean, what else do you want to say? Is there anything else you want to say, like the Potato Nation or so you have sort of plans for the weekend, anything?
I don't even know really what to say. I said I kind of just woke up. I mean, I guess I want to say thank you to all the people supporting me. Oh, there is one thing I wanted to say.
Yeah.
There's someone in the comments section, his name's Pseudo.
Yeah.
You know what? And that fruitcake says he fights. I hear the fruitcake fights at 135, 145. And, you got the balls, man. After April 9th, I'm free. Let's do this. Me and you, man. You got a big mouth.
This guy knows how to cut a promo, right, Mike?
You know, maybe we could do a Grand Prix, a Cage Potato Grand Prix, and we'll have some of the guys that can't stand each other square off, man. And settle their differences.
I'd love to do that.
You better bring Red Fire Engine and
Little Red Engine.
And another band troll, because I might just Michael Bisping him right out of that cage.
The main event should be like one of us versus Bloodstained Lane or Aaron True. Like, they both fight, right?
Yeah, pretend fights, though, right?
We could have a catch wave, you and Dana White.
It would be a catch wave.
Or Ariane. We'll have you fight Ariane.
That would be more my speed. Well, that's it. I mean, that's pretty much all, you know, I had for you. I mean, we really support you. I wish you the best of luck. It's really cool that, you know, we have, you know, Potato Nation representative at the tryouts. You know, whatever, take some photos, get some stories, get us what you can, and you know, I'm sure it'll work out for the best. You're on your way, man.
Yeah, I was approached by one of the Jason, one of the posters who.
Moles.
Yeah, Jason Moles. He has one of his coolest last names, you know. Guess it's a good thing he's not part of an army. His buddy, the Fight Nerd, has approached me.
Yeah.
So I think we're gonna hang out a little bit when I get there.
Yeah, definitely. Fight Nerd Matt Kaplowitz. You know, he's also interested in your story too, and he actually reached out to me too and said, you know, I'll shoot some video of this guy. You know, if you want an exclusive video about, you know, just about Jeff's story and his journey, and I'm like, yeah, dude, whatever. You know, put something together, and then, you know, whatever. We'd love to see anything. So.
I guess my last thing I just want to say is thanks for the support from those who, you know, contributed. It was a lot of money. And I know right now in the United States and all over the world, money isn't an easy thing to come by.
Right. Taking it down to a serious level.
Yeah, right?
Things are tough all over.
Yeah, no. And I'm going to kill you if I refuse, Pseudo.
Well, good luck, man.
Good luck, man. We appreciate it. Just keep us posted. Give, you know, shoot me some texts. So, you know, we'll talk sometime this weekend, maybe. And good luck. Let us know what happens out there. All right, man.
Call me up anytime, man.
Okay, cool. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Karma ate my cat, everybody.
Oh, see you later, Mike. Bye, Ben.
See you,
War Pineda Nation.
On March 19th, Brendan Schaub continues his climb up the UFC heavyweight ladder when he faces legendary striker Mirko Krokop Filipovic on the main card of UFC 128, Shogun vs. Jones. The Ultimate Fighter 10 finalist is carrying the momentum of a three-fight win streak in the octagon, and we're happy to have him on the show right now. Brendan, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
All right. So I know you have a lot of respect for Krokop. You've said you're expecting, you know, the version of Krokop that used to run through guys back in the day. But honestly, what did you think about his last performance against Frank Mir?
Pretty lackluster, but you can't put that all on Krokop. You know, I think that was, both his fault and Frank Mir. So, that fight was awful. But I'm not sure what was going on there. I think Frank kind of gave him a little too much respect, or I don't know, maybe he didn't feel like fighting that night, and same with Krokop. So it turned out to be more of kind of a friendly sparring match, which isn't what people pay for when they pay for the UFC fights.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, speaking of giving him too much respect, I mean, when you're in the cage with him, you know, what's the mood going to be like for you? Is there any chance you'll fall into that sort of Pat Barry trap of respecting him too much or enjoying the experience too much?
No. And I think Dana White realized that, and that's the reason they gave me this fight. I'm pretty intense in the octagon, and they know that's my game. So, man, I'm a huge fan of Krokop, and, as much as anyone else in the UFC, but same time, this is business for me. So I'll shake his hand afterwards.
Yeah. What does a win over Mirko Krokop do for your career? I mean, what would you like it to do?
Man, I'm carrying a lot of momentum into the fight. I'm on a three-fight win streak and just be a monster of an opponent in Gabriel Gonzaga. And a win over Krokop just kind of keeps me climbing the ladder, man. And the goal of this thing is to get to the title and eventually be the title holder. So it just inches me closer to that goal.
Yeah. And speaking of Gonzaga, that was your last fight. It was also the first fight in your career that made it three rounds. Do you feel like you fought safer against him in any way compared to your previous fights?
No, not safer. With Gonzaga, he's such a monster on the ground, and probably the best heavyweight in the world, at least top three on the ground. So with him, it's really hard to commit to your combos, and you kind of got to pick single shots. So that might have had a factor, but man, I thought I had him at the end of that first round. He saved by the bell. But other than that, no, I definitely, there was anything different. I still throw my punches, just, the thought of getting taken down was definitely in the back of my mind.
Yeah. So was there anything in particular that you would have approved about your performance from that fight?
There's always stuff I could have done better. There's opportunities in that fight where, I should have stayed on him more, and I'm always looking for the finish. But guys are tough, especially when you get to this upper echelon of guys. They're a lot smarter, they're a lot tougher. So I think the longer the fight goes, the better for me. I definitely think I'm up there as far as cardio wise with the rest of the heavyweights. Mm-hmm.
You came in just under 240 pounds for your last two fights, making you one of the smaller heavyweights in the division. We always hear this debate about a cruiserweight division. Do you think there should be a cruiserweight division or some other division between 205 and 265?
I mean, it might be nice. The thing is, there's not enough guys, who would be above that division. If there was a cruiserweight, you'd have guys like Dos Santos, Kane, myself, Chuck Congo, a number of other guys, and then there's just not enough talented heavyweights to split the division up. As far as me weighing in at 238, 240, my entire camp until the weekend, until I fly into wherever I'm fighting, I'm usually around 50 to 55. The week I get to the fight, nerves get to me, it's hard for me to eat. So usually I walk in the cage, I'm at least 45, if not 50. So that's why I usually weigh in pretty light.
Got it. Now, you're nominated for a Tequila Casadores Spirit Award for UFC 128. Tell us a little about why you're supporting the Colorado Humane Society and SPCA.
Yeah, it's a great charity, and I'm definitely a big animal lover. Always have been. And for me to be nominated again for this award, I won it last time. It's such a cool honor. And, you know, I'm expecting to win it this time, too. I got tough competition, Akiyama and Jim Miller. But I think the fans behind me, we're definitely going to win this thing again.
Definitely. How do you like to spend your time when you're not fighting or training?
Oh, man, when I'm not fighting or training, I'm pretty lazy. I just like to chill out, and I watch a lot of TV series like Dexter and Entourage and stuff like that, but I don't watch them when they come out. I wait till I can get all the seasons. So,
yeah. So your training partner, Nate Marquardt, is also on the UFC 128 card against Yoshihiro Akiyama, you just mentioned. How do you see that fight playing out?
You know, I think Nate's going to get in his face, and it's going to be a rough night for Akiyama. I think Nate has a little more tools in his bag, and it's going to be a good night for us.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your grudge teammates, your buddy Shane Carwin is, I think, still officially without his next fight scheduled. You know, we've heard a rumor about Carwin versus Czech Congo. Do you know if that's in the works? Do you have any insight?
No, I know he hasn't been contacted on that, and I would know, man.
I hear that. What's it like having MC Hammer as a manager at this point?
You know, MC Hammer's awesome, man. He's more of the social media guy, my day-to-day manager, and the guy who I deal with 99.8% of the time is Lex McMahon, and MC Hammer is kind of the face of the Alchemist branch, and he's great as far as Twitter and Facebook, and yeah, he's a smart dude, so he's definitely good to be part of the team.
All right. Well, I guess finally, Shogun versus John Jones in the UFC 128 main event. Who you got in that one?
That's tough, man. I'll take John Jones, though.
Specifically, stoppage, decision, what?
Yeah, I'll take second round TKO.
All right. Well, that's about all I have for you. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we let you go?
That's it, man. Just vote for me for the Tequila Cazadores Award, and you can check me out on Twitter. It's just at Brendan Schaub.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Brendan, and good luck in the fight.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Well, that about does it for this installment of the Bum Rush. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to come back to Cage Potato Saturday night for our live blog of UFC 128. Take care, Potato Nation, and keep your eye on the site for more updates about our free Cage Potato campaign.
Yeah.